This is John Floridis. Welcome to part one of a special two-part musician spotlight featuring Bonnie Raitt.
Looks like we've been butting heads again, baby. Lately seems like all we ever do. Can't remember when things got so crazy. All I know is I don't know what to do. I guess we ought to stop and think it over. Decide if what we want there's enough of. It's tearing us apart. It cuts right through the heart. It's an unintended consequence of love. Remember how we fell into each other, baby? It's all we could do to get up out of bed. You used to say nobody loved you better. I used to hang on to every word you said. What happened to those brave and tender lovers? How could we break? Expectations run aground. It's an unintended consequence of love.
This is John Floridis. Welcome to Musicians Spotlight. I'm very pleased to be speaking today to Bonnie Raitt. How are you doing, Bonnie?
I'm just great. Thank you, John.
Well, it is a real pleasure and an honor to have you on this program. I've told folks a number of times since I mentioned that I was going to be interviewing you that you were one of the artists that have come through Montana that, you know, you're one of the ones that got away. somehow we didn't get you on the show, and it was on the top of my list. Like, oh, I've, you know, got to get Bonnie Raitt on this program. She's a natural for it. So,
well, it sounds like you've had a great repertoire of fantastic musicians, so I'm glad to be in the pantheon now.
Yes, you're in the pantheon. Thank you so much for being in the pantheon. Bonnie's most recent recording is Dig In Deep, and I'll tell folks right now that BonnieRaitt.com is where you can find out more about what's going on with Bonnie in all areas, including recordings and touring, activism, and all the kind of stuff that you're into. So, Bonnie, I think what I want to do is we're going to be featuring a lot of music from Dig Deep. Let's start with that. Let's start with talking about Dig Deep and how your most recent recording project came together, and just some of the stuff that went on to make that happen.
Well, we go in kind of 4 or 5 year cycles. You know, it takes about a year to get at least to get the tunes together. I don't normally write very much, but this particular one, I actually contributed 5 songs, 2 of my own, and 3 co-writes. And that was primarily because after 19 records, it's really nice to be able to add some new feels and grooves that I've been missing into my live set. So I basically make records so I can do the songs live. And that was the inspiration. And, you know, I've got a really wonderful band. I've been recording with some of these guys over 30 years. But it's the same band I record with that I tour with. And we had so much fun on the Slipstream tour. And I came off of that 2 year cycle when we actually get the record out. So it's a year to prep, a year to make and book the tour and get the sets designed and rehearsals and line up the opening act and which social groups, action groups we're going to be supporting. And then the tour itself usually goes about 2 years. So we're about a year and a half into the Dig In Deep tour now. We just finished 2 months with James Taylor opening in stadiums and baseball stadiums. So that was a blast. So we're back finishing up the Western states that we haven't hit yet. And this will be rounding out the cycle. So back a couple of years ago when we started, I just knew that I was going to, you know, what I usually do is try to really look at a lot of range of music that I love and find some, try to find some musical and lyrical ideas that I haven't already covered in the previous records, which was really the impetus for why I wanted to write some things. And I had some things to say. There was a political song on there called Coming Round Is Going Through. And then there's a very personal song at the end of the record that I wrote about reckoning that comes with losing some family and romantic partners. So, you know, there was a couple of different perspectives that I wanted to add in this time that were really personal. And the rest of the co-writes were really fun to do as well. So I'm really proud of this one. And the tour's been going great. We've been getting great reviews. And as you say on the site, we've kept track of a lot of that stuff that's the highlights. So, you know, I hope people will enjoy the music and come and see us as well.
Are you drawn, Bonnie, to subjects like the one you just mentioned? I mean, that's the idea of losing family members through the breakups of relationships and so forth. I mean, it seems like that's the kind of stuff that a lot of people don't want to touch on because it kind of hits close to the bone. But it seems like throughout your career, you've always been really good at kind of confronting some of that stuff. And I'm thinking back to Nick of Time and you know, the songs about, you know, of aging, of middle age and so forth.
Yeah. Well, it's not something I touch on very often. As I said, I don't write that much, but the Nick of Time was really, you know, something that really, I wanted to write something from my own experience, and God, it's hard to believe that's like 27 years ago. But that song got singled out when the record came out, and because it was a topic of aging and acknowledging, you know, kind of the what you go through at that point in your life. At that point, I was about to turn 40, and you know, in the years since, I have touched base with some very personal songs about, you know, dealing with my parents. There's one about my dad called Circle Dance, and you know, some various ballads that I've touched on have to, a lot to do as a great torch song, and a lot of great love songs are about when love goes wrong, you know, or when you wish you had been a better partner, or a betrayal, or longing, or unrequited love, or a terrible breakup. So if men and women and loving partners got along, I wouldn't have a gig. So it's really, the ballads are where I really live. I mean, I Can't Make You Love Me, although I didn't write it, it's songs like that, and another cornerstone of my set, Angel from Montgomery, although that's more of a point of view, almost a short story from a point of view of a woman who's really endured a life. There were a lot of different promises and dreams were something that never happened for her. So, you know, these songs, and especially the ballads, cut really deep for me, and that's the ones that have appealed to me by other singers like Joni Mitchell or Judy Collins when I was starting out. But the great jazz singers that have imbued some of the great, great ballad singing over the years, whether it's Frank Sinatra or Ella Fitzgerald, but especially even watching musical that my dad were in, you know, singing If I Loved You and Hey There. I mean, there's nothing like a ballad to cut right to the soul.
Like a heartbeat, timing is everything. I took a look at love when love looked away. How cruel is it that fate has to find me all alone with something to say? I've been thinking, tweaking and rethinking all the things I would tell you someday. I can hear it while I'm sitting here all alone with something to say. I want to tell you I love you. I want to tell you I'm sorry. Away. It would be clever witty and titled, all alone with something to say.
Bonnie, you mentioned a couple of those tunes that you're very well known for, the John Prine tune. I'm thinking of the Chris Smither tune, Love You Like a Man.
Oh, thank you.
And the funny story, I know Chris a little bit and I've interviewed him, and he told a great story about, you know, talking to some woman who was covering that tune and trying to convince her that he'd written it. And she was just convinced there's no way that a dude would have wrote that song. It's Bonnie Raitt's song, so just shut up and leave me alone.
Isn't that hilarious? His original version, of course, is I Could Love You Like a Man, which I just loved so much. I just love all the lyrics. I mean, he's the smartest modern blues man I know. You know, he writes, mm-hmm. I mean, he's up there on a level of, you know, the tunes that he's written are so complex. Billy Payne's another one of my favorites, who I've covered two or three songs of his over the years, the keyboard player from Little Feet. But, you know, like Randy mm-hmm. Newman and Jackson Brown and John Prine, I mean, there's people writing on a level that is so far and away at great literature at some point. You know, you have to just acknowledge sure. that these are masters like Paul Simon as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what I was getting at is with folks like that, and I'm going to toss in Richard Thompson. Of course, he's been on the program as well. Those artists kind of, you know, make sense in a way of like, oh, these are people that I would think Bonnie Raitt would cover. But then what I wanted to get to is you can also inhabit these songs that nobody – well, unless they followed your career, they would probably get this. But a lot of people would not have anticipated, say, on Dig Deep, your cover of the NXS tune, Need You Tonight.
I knew you were coming.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, and, no, and I've been answering for that one for the last couple of years. I'm a fan first. I never expected to do this for a living. I taught myself guitar when I was a kid just to be able to play Joan Baez songs and cry in my room and you know, play and... And when I went to the Soviet Union when I was a teenager on part of a Quaker study trip, I played in the parks there. I played all these peace songs and, you know, hoping we could change the world with just a voice and a guitar like we all did when we picked up the folk music craze that was going on through the colleges and camps. And so many people learned guitar as I did when I was a kid. And then, you know, between the Beatles and the Stones and falling in love with blues and Motown and all the musical richness that came out of the 60s, I'm such a fan of so many different styles of music, and I think I love covering other people's tunes and putting my own spin on it, which I did my first radio hit in 1977 after six albums, I think, out was a kind of an Al Green inspired version of Runaway, Del Shannon's Runaway, which was a hit when I was a kid.
And I remember it well.
And then, you know, I've covered Burning Down the House. I've covered I Thank You by Sam and Dave. I mean, so many, when you're an interpreter of a wide range of music, you know, it's basically every record is filled with covers as far as I'm concerned, and there's only a few originals. So the NXS song, from the first time I heard that band, I fell in love with them, and I wanted to do that song. It was just like right down the line on Slipstream, which is a great Jerry Rafferty song. I was going to say Jerry Raggedy. Jerry Rafferty from around the same time that Runaway came out. And I've had those two songs on my list of things to cover, and I'm just waiting for a record to couch them in the right place. So people, including Australia, where the band is from, and the writers of the tune, you know, Andrew Ferris, of course, Michael is gone, but Michael, Andrew loved our version of it. So I'm really proud of it. And it's one of the most fun songs to sing in the set because it's very sexy.
This is John Floridis. You're listening to Musicians Spotlight. I'm speaking today with Bonnie Raitt. Bonnie, one of the other things I wanted to ask you about was your history of collaboration. And, you know, throughout the years, you've collaborated with folks, you know, your early influences like John Lee Hooker, your contemporaries, like you mentioned, James Taylor, Keb Moe, I know you played with here in Montana. I know you've been doing some shows with folks like Anders Osborne. Can you talk a little bit about just the importance of collaboration in what you do?
Well, it's such a gift to be able to be asked to duet with Willie Nelson or B.B. King or my dad or Tony Bennett. I mean, some of the dream dates that I couldn't have imagined as a teenager in my room learning the guitar, that I would that what my eclectic taste would bring me so many great joys of being able to duet with Charles Brown and Ruth Brown and John Lee Hooker. And you know, because I do so many different styles of music, there's really hardly, almost in the 50 years I've been doing this, there's hardly anybody I haven't worked with that was not on my bucket list. So it is just an incredible honor and joy to be able to sing a great song with someone that you admire and love. And when they call me up, you know, as Tony Bennett did, and wanted to sing something with me, I mean, can you imagine Ray Charles and Tony Bennett and John Reid and, you know, John Lee Hooker and B.B. King and Aretha Franklin? It's the list goes on and on. And, you know, when we were compiling the discography for my website, I couldn't even believe it was over 100 different collaborations. So those are the ones that really stand out for me, although I love playing. As far as I'm concerned, collaborating with my band every night is a wonderful gift. But mm-hmm. I think it's really kept it very, very rewarding for me to be able to not only pick just the perfect song for the perfect duet of our voices. You know, the two live albums that I've done, one in 95, where I had Brian Adams and Kim Wilson from the Fabulous Thunderbirds and Jackson Browne. And, you know, we had a slew of duet partners on that record. And then on the Decades Live when I had Alison Krauss and Keb Moe and Ben Harper and Nora Jones. So I've really been blessed, even in my own songs, to have these guys join me on my tunes.
Well, when we talk about collaborations, you know, the name that comes up so often, and I, you know, opened up the Facebook page to suggestions for questions. I'll get to that in a second. I had like the page almost, you know, went down from all the people making comments. But of course, one of the names that comes up so often is Lowell George. And one of the questions specifically was his influence on your instrumental voice, you know, the big slide guitar. And that's, of course, you know, just something that you're so well known for. And, you know, I think, I don't know if, you know, obviously a lot of folks do know that, you know, his influence on you and your collaboration together and establishing that voice, but maybe touch on that a little bit if that's okay.
Sure. Well, you know, I taught myself to play slide when I heard it on a record in 64. I had never seen anyone do it, but it said bottleneck. So I soaked the label off of a cold medicine bottle, of a chlorocetin bottle, and put it on my middle finger, which was the only one I'd never seen it, so it's actually not a very practical finger to use. But by the time I was playing Mississippi Fred McDowell and Robert Johnson and Son House, I was a freshman in college and just sort of loved playing slide guitar. I then heard Ry Cooder, and I had never heard anything like it. I mean, he played with the Stones on that Performance soundtrack, and many people think that, you know, he was the one who showed. I mean, Keith has said that he learned open tunings from Ry, but mm-hmm. Ry was the first one to take blues to such an unbelievably inventive, cool new way. And then Little Feat, I had already made a couple of albums before I heard Little Feat, and I heard Dixie Chicken was the first one I heard, and then I heard I heard Sailing Shoes, and went back and heard the first album and just fell in love with Little Feat, as I had with Ry Cooder. So I was already playing slide, but I wanted to know how he got that. Lowell had a certain really compressed tone, and in fact, he gave me one of his Dynacomp MXR compressors and said, this is how you get that tone to last. So even I had played slide, really influenced by a lot of the blues guys and especially Ry Cooder, but Lowell was the one who turned me on to this particular pedal that allows you to really hold the note for a long way and kind of slink it around and play different volumes of it, which you can't, you know, it makes electric guitar so much more evocative in many ways than acoustic guitar. So I love Lowell's singing and his writing, and there was nobody better, you know. He just was so inventive on the slide guitar. We lost him way too soon, but I would have to say he and Ry Cooder were equally very much influential on my style.
Thank you.
Well, Bonnie, this is a question that I've been waiting to ask for all these years. I told you you were one of the folks that got away from me and didn't get to be on the program. I wanted to talk about, I'm going to quote an article that I read in the New Yorker. I'll give credit to the writer, Paul Ellie. And I love this. He said, in hearing your covering of that NXS tune that we referenced earlier, he called it a sharp woman's swagger over big guitar chords and a strong kick drum. And what I want to ask you about is the swagger. And I want to ask you about owning the concept of owning the stage. And I always reference the classical violinist Isaac Stern, because that's the first time I ever heard that concept. And he like physically demonstrated it in something I saw on PBS at some point. You know, how you walk out onto the stage and how you own a stage. And anyone who has seen you perform has seen this. And what I want to know is, at what time did you walk on a stage and know that you could own it like that?
Oh my God. Well, thank you. Again, this is like never been asked this before. I don't think about it. If I think about how I'm going to come across, I probably would get self-conscious, and then that fairy dust would drop away and I'd just be like the Wizard of Oz going, pay no attention to the person behind.
The woman behind the Stratocaster.
I feel more probably myself on stage than I do off stage. So, and I watched my dad inhabit the characters, even though I'm playing myself, and there's something that happens when you step out on the stage where the audience's appreciation and expectation and love of you is so apparent, and the challenge of making a connection with them so that they're not disappointed, or so that your heart is open immediately and you're going to give 100%. That's all I'm out there. I just, when your mark gets set, they announce you and you walk out. I don't think about how I'm walking or how I'm acting. I'm just really in the moment, and how the song makes me feel is what makes me move the way I do. And if I had to think about my facial expressions, like if I, every, all of us have to look at photographs to approve and look at videos. And now, you know, to be in my late 60s with high definition cameras blowing up your face to the size of a football stadium, it's really... I try really hard to not pay attention to what I look like while I'm singing or playing. Otherwise, it would just make me too self-conscious and I wouldn't be able to do it. So have to forget about it. And if people think I have a good swagger, it feels like that when I'm playing the guitar and rocking out with my guys. I feel exactly like what it looks like. When I've had to look at videos and say, you know, this particular shot here, this angle is real, not just flattering, but it nails how I feel when I'm playing. Mm. So I hear what you're saying, but I'm happy if a swagger's a good thing, because that's how I'm feeling inside. You know, like the swagger on that NXS song, man. I mean, believe me, there's times when I feel like I wonder whether it's even legal acting like that. So I'm not thinking about trying of how I'm coming across. I'm just sending it out there the way I'm feeling it.
This is John Floridis. You've been listening to part one of a special two-part musician spotlight with Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to contact us, you can do so through the Montana Public Radio website, mtpr.org, as well as through our own website, musicianspotlight.org. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our program is available as a downloadable podcast from those websites, as well as through iTunes. Musicians Spotlight is a production of Montana Public Radio.